Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Virtual reality is a familiar topic in the tech world. Now the technology is being applied in the realm of medicine. A new VR startup company recently partnered with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles to use therapeutic virtual reality to treat pain and anxiety in patients. Dr. Brennan Spiegel is the Director of Health Services Research at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
How does virtual reality apply in the real world in this way?
Well, for our patients who are in a hospital, you think about what it's like to be in a hospital, and many of us have been in a hospital. This is a place nobody wants to go to. Our patients suffer physically, they suffer emotionally, they suffer with social isolation. So the idea of being able to provide a way for our patients to escape the four walls of the hospital, even if for only 20 or 30 minutes at a time, is where virtual reality offers us incredible opportunities.
Virtual reality hasn't always been considered this way because it, you know, makes it has other effects. It has side effects on some people. Are you comfortable with the way the technology has evolved and that it's reached this point where it does more good than harm?
All right. Well, as somebody who suffers from motion sickness from time to time myself,
yeah,
I'm acutely aware of that. And that's always been the concern with virtual reality. So for people who haven't tried virtual reality, this discussion is sort of theoretical. Until you've actually tried it, it's hard to even explain how it can, in a way, hijack your brain, both for gaming or maybe for not such great things or in positive, compelling, emotionally positive ways. But the side effect that's most common is a little bit of dizziness. With the newer technologies, and we're using the new Samsung Gear headset,
mm-hmm.
And with a fast processor on a phone, there's pretty minimal effects. So we've been actually quite successful in avoiding that with our patients.
So in treating pain, what kinds of pain are we talking about being treated with virtual reality?
So we just published our first study on this, and we've been approaching all kinds of pain. Anybody in the hospital who has a pain score of 3 or greater on that usual 0 to 10 score that, you know, that doctors may have asked you about before,
mm-hmm.
or nurses. So this includes people with pain and orthopedic pain, headaches, abdominal pain. I happen to be a gastroenterologist and specialize in irritable bowel syndrome and chronic abdominal pain. And we've found incredible benefits for many, not everyone, but for many patients suffering from abdominal pain. I use that in my clinic every week. So there's a variety of different types of pain that virtual reality seems to help with.
And, well, first of all, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the use of virtual reality in treating pain and anxiety in hospital patients. My guest is Dr. Brennan Spiegel. He's the Director of Health Services Research at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So if I have, irritable bowel syndrome, what is a virtual reality program going to look like for me? What's it going to be?
Mm-hmm. So it's a little different for different people. And if we think of virtual reality like a therapy, then what we're building is sort of a pharmacy of therapies, where I need to be able to reach onto the shelf and pull off evidence-based therapies. So it's different for different people. So for abdominal pain, we have found, just really so far through trial and error, that certain visualizations that are kind of freeing or that are kind of upward looking towards the sky or sort of nature-oriented tend to alleviate pain. But that's really just from trial and error. So we're working with a variety of different visualizations to find out which ones kind of work the best for which types of pain.
Have you noticed a different kinds of visualizations affecting different kinds of pain differently?
I can't say we've gotten that far into it other than sort of anecdote. So, for example, with abdominal pain, there are existing hypnotherapy routines. I'm not a hypnotherapist at all,
mm-hmm.
although there is evidence behind that,
mm-hmm.
where there's a visualization where you imagine sort of like a balloon coming out and floating up into the air as if it's taking your gas and bloating up into the sky and removing itself from you. Very metaphorical,
mm-hmm.
metaphorical narrative. So these are the kinds of insights that we're drawing from as we start thinking about what's the best visualization for the right patient. But that's a work in progress.
You're a scientist. Were you a skeptic?
Absolutely, right. I mean, so I teach public health at UCLA. I teach evidence-based medicine, health economics. I'm sort of a numbers guy. And, you know, I had heard about virtual reality for games and, you know, kids kind of locked in with these things on their face for all day long. And that didn't sound like anything I was interested in. But when I first tried it, I'm working with this company called Applied VR. And they actually put me on top of a building virtually. And they said, jump off the building. And I said, there's no chance I'm jumping off this building. They said, well, you know, you're standing on a carpet in a conference room. I said, you know, I know that, but my brain doesn't know that.
Uh-huh.
So that visceral experience was so compelling that I realized we need to at least try this. So over time, and that's why we study this with actual research, we've been able to demonstrate really some spectacular benefits.
Let's talk about anxiety now, because you know, when you're talking about the way you just did, you realize that it could, you know, and that we also know that the brain is more malleable and can be, you know, changed in a way that we didn't believe 20 years ago. What about anxiety? How does it affect anxiety?
Right. I mean, you're right. There's this sort of old theory that the brain sort of sits there like a ball of gelatin or something, and kind of passively travels around with us throughout our life. But in fact, like all the other organs in our body, it can change in both function and literally in its size and shape. So we have the ability over time to mold our brains. And the idea with anxiety, and I'm not a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. But there's sort of maladaptive responses to otherwise normal stimuli. A hypervigilance that often comes from fear and underlying depression as well. So, you know, we really don't know to this day what truly causes anxiety and depression. There's, you know, 86 billion connections per cubic centimeter of brain tissue, which is more connections than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So for us to pretend to understand what the brain is doing is really a fallacy. So, you know, the best we can do right now is use medications, which have some benefit for sure. But virtual reality, we don't yet know how it's working. But this idea of being able to reformulate introspection and to rethink about your place in the world through mindful meditation, which we know from decades, if not centuries, of experience works, mm-hmm. Virtual reality is a tool to sort of help us do that more fluidly.
I immediately thought of the dentist or anybody who gives shots. Those are two big phobias people have.
Yeah, for phobias, there's a lot of really good data that virtual reality works to reduce fears of spiders, of, you know, animals, of being in the elevator, all sorts of fears people have. Virtual reality provides sort of a safe environment to practice that over and over again without actually experiencing it. But also just acute pain, virtual reality can help bridge patients through that painful experience. And the best data comes from the burn literature, where patients with severe burns during bandage changes, and there's really no pain worse than that a human can experience. There's evidence that virtual reality can substantially help patients during that period, greater than pain medications are able to.
Brad in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Brennan Spiegel at Cedars-Sinai in L.A. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Wanted to find out if there had been any experiments or research into the use of the virtual reality in the extended care market with Alzheimer patients to decrease agitation?
Hmm. Right, that's a really important question. I'm not aware, it may exist, but I'm not aware of peer-reviewed research in that population in particular. Certainly in the extended care environment, it's important to have ways to sort of change up the day, to provide different stimuli, to engage different parts of the brain. And this is very, very important. It just so happens, starting in the fall on CBS, there's going to be a new TV show that explores digital health. It's a drama called Pure Genius. And there will be some storylines in this TV show that explore some of these concepts in a sort of mythical world of television, but we need to do more actual research to understand how it can help patients with Alzheimer's and other chronic neurocognitive disorders.
What about people just waiting in a emergency waiting room or any kind of waiting room, waiting to be treated for something? That's when a lot of the anxiety builds. Is that when you're thinking about using some of this?
Well, it's amazing you say that, because I just recently met with our colleagues in the emergency department, and they said exactly the same thing. We have a very busy emergency department here in the middle of urban Los Angeles, and sometimes patients have to sit in the hallway in a gurney, so they don't even get a room to sit in. So, yeah, so there's not only the physical space of being in an uncomfortable physical environment, but the emotional experience, negative experience of waiting for diagnoses, tests, or just waiting to see a doctor. So it turns out some patients are very interested in using this and enjoy it, and others really would rather not have something on their face at the very moment that they're losing control of their environment. To cede further control to sort of this mythical world is off-putting for some people, but for others it's really helpful. So that's something we're looking at right now in the emergency department.
It's sort of exciting, too, to think about what virtual reality or non-opioid treatments, therapies could do. You know, we're in the middle of this huge crisis with opioid addiction, stretching from legal prescription drugs all the way to heroin. And it does make me wonder, what about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is a public health hazard. It's a major, major problem, the inappropriate overuse of opioids in America. And that's a whole different show. But we've seen virtual reality help there as well. In fact, just about 3 weeks ago, I was called in to see a patient with severe abdominal pain who is receiving ketamine. It's a very powerful analgesic by intravenous infusion. Mm-hmm. And nothing was helping this lady. And we talked about the mind-body connection what we call the brain-gut axis in gastroenterology, and how virtual reality can help reorient the mind to the body. And after that sort of dialogue, we tried virtual reality, and she literally said, "I'm ready to leave the hospital." And I'll say, in the 18 years I've been practicing medicine, I can't do much more for a patient than that. And I'm not saying this is a miracle cure, but my goodness, when it works, it really, really works.
Oh, how has the study been conducted? How are you doing that? Is it first just talking to somebody? Do you have to kind of talk them into it, or how does it work?
Yeah, you know, of course, we don't want to coerce anybody.
Right.
This is an IRB-approved research study. So there is a fine line between explaining what the technology is and, you know, obviously, you know, over-promising something. That's what the research is about. So that's a very important point, because in our initial experiences, a lot of patients are not interested in, you know, putting goggles on their face when they're in the hospital. And in fact, we found in general that older people, in general, were less willing to try the technology than younger people. So it's sort of a digital divide that we've seen in other technologies. So we're working on how to script the description in a way that doesn't overpromise. In fact, we're working on that right now with our IRB.
The only VR I've used is with the Google card, and when I got it as part of a New York Times subscription.
Right.
And it reminded me of a ViewMaster. I'm old enough to remember the old ViewMasters, which was sort of a 3D experience. How do you describe it to people who are completely unfamiliar with the technology and what it can do now?
Right. Yep. Well, I'm just old enough to have used ViewMasters as a kid, too. And, you know, ViewMasters have come back now with the whole virtual reality craze. And, you know, what it has in common is it's stereoscopic. So you're looking through two lenses onto two replicated images. So it's three-dimensional. The difference with the ViewMaster is the ViewMaster doesn't track with your head movement.
Right.
Whereas the virtual reality takes advantage of the gyroscope in the smartphone. So wherever your head moves, the visual image tracks with you. So it's really just a three-dimensional view, just like a ViewMaster, but it's in 360 degrees in all directions. And that's the part that provides this immersive experience that leads your brain to believe that you have been physically moved to a new location.
It's very fascinating, and I appreciate your time today talking about it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Dr. Brennan Spiegel, he's Director of Health Services Research at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, where they're studying and working with virtual reality and treating pain and anxiety in hospital patients. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher, your host. The test for HIV is faster and more accurate than ever, but too few Americans would know because too few are getting tested at all. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than half of adults in the U.S. have never been tested for HIV. And stigma seems to be at the heart of the problem. Last week, Britain's Prince Harry took to Facebook to broadcast his own HIV test live in front of millions. Joining us now is the Director of Prevention at Equitas Health. That's the former AIDS Resource Center, Tanya Slack-Peterson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Prince Harry, as I said, live streamed himself getting tested for HIV on Facebook. It went viral.
Yeah.
Why was this live stream important for breaking down the stigma surrounding HIV?
Well, I think it shows somebody notable taking an interest in this disease and that affects so many people. HIV is something that to some degree has kind of flown under the radar for quite some time, but it is still here. Infection rates are steady. And so I think it was really remarkable that someone with such presence took the time to do this live and show how important it is.
We have an email from Jeremy who says it's great that Prince Harry is trying to destigmatize HIV and HIV testing. And it's all well and good when you have a live test and the test results come back negative. Mm-hmm. But I feel there would be a very strong stigma if his test had come back positive. I mean, that would be the real breaking point. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with Jeremy, but what about that?
Well, I think, having somebody know their status is the key. Right? There are too many people who don't know their status, positive or negative. And that extends to things like other STIs, right? Other sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis. Those are all still prevalent. And having people get tested and knowing their risks is the key there. So positive or negative, I think there's real value there in sending a message that this is an important process to engage in.
A Kaiser Family Foundation survey found that more than one in three Americans have at least one misconception about HIV transmission. Talk about those common misconceptions.
I think I already touched on was the fact that it is not still
a problem,
yeah. Right? And it is. It definitely is. So I think that's one of the most prominent misconceptions. And among those folks who know that it is a problem, we hear that it is a chronic condition, which it is, and that it's easily managed. Frequently we hear it compared to things like diabetes, and it is manageable. It's a manageable condition. But what I think folks don't put into perspective is that if one can avoid having a chronic health condition, they would be better off. They would have more free time on their hands to do other things in their lives for sure. The idea of who's affected by HIV has been a persistent misconception out there. And so, the age range that's currently increasing in infections most rapidly are young people. Mm-hmm. Specifically in Ohio, that's ages 20 to 24. That's the largest group of new diagnoses.
Is that because of sexual transmission or other things?
Most of that
age group?
Yeah, most of that's attributed to sexual transmission. And I'll say that age group, in my own experience, has a feeling of invincibility, right? But there have been a lot of analyses put into that. So In Ohio, we have an educational system that's been abstinence only for quite some time. So I suspect there's a number of those folks who missed out on some key information. Some folks don't have the same access to resources that you do at an older age, or there might be more stigma, or if young people are on their parents' insurance, they may be reluctant to test. But what we see is also in that young group are young African-American men that have sex with men. So when we look at the layers of demographics there, it's this one group that is growing in infections at a much larger rate. And I think a lot of that is due to stigma as well.
Cultural stigma in the Black community.
Surrounding condom use to some degree. Surrounding
To avoid it in the first place.
Is also some stigma from what I can tell you through conversations and interactions with the community, just generally speaking around the GLBTQ populations. So, you know, if an individual feels stigmatized about the fact that they're a man who has sex with men, the likelihood or their interest in getting a test and then also knowing that they may have HIV could be greatly reduced, because then there's more layers of stigma there in their communities.
For most of us, it's been 35, going on 40 years now since the effect of AIDS hit this country and around the world. Things have changed a lot. There's great treatments for HIV and AIDS. There are great tests available for it now. If you have a question or comment, that's what we're talking about. My guest is Tanya Slack-Peterson. She is the Director of Prevention at Equitas Health. That's the former AIDS Resource Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's talk about the tests. They have changed a lot. Now, 23 years ago, when I got married in Michigan, they required an AIDS test. They may still, for all I know, I don't know. But I got it here.
Okay.
And it was a big hassle. I had to wait in line for about an hour. It was very stressful because everyone's, you know, chewing their nails off. And then I had to wait another 2 or 3 weeks to get the results of the test. A lot of that's changed, right?
Oh, yeah. That is totally different
now.
That's
the olden days.
Yeah. So folks had to work up courage frequently to go and get their test and then come back again, have a second set of courage to come back and get those results. So it's a totally different landscape now. There are tests that can produce results in 1 minute. That's what Prince Harry had done on his Facebook feed. A lot of tests take somewhere around 10 to 20 minutes, but folks leave with their results that same day. And it's wonderful because the test not only is more rapid, meaning you get your results in that same instant, in same meeting, but also it detects HIV so much sooner. So some of what's called the third generation tests, or some of the more recent testing technology, detects HIV on average in as few as 21 days.
It used to be you had to wait until you were really... It had something like 3 or 4 months, wasn't it, originally?
The first version of really good and reliable testing technology told you to wait 3 to 6 months, that your very last test should be at 6 months to kind of cover all your bases. And now that we could detect it at 21 days, when individuals might be most infectious, their virus gets into their body and spikes, is really key. So testing frequently, testing often, if someone knows they're at risk, is really important, because the sooner you know, the less likely you are to infect a partner.
I didn't know you were more infectious when you first get it.
Yeah. So the way that the body responds to HIV is, once the virus enters the body, it kind of has all of these healthy cells to infect. So it has a spike in what's called viral load.
It has to work harder.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it replicates quickly. Because it found this new home with healthy cells that it wants to infect. And then your body is so smart, it really starts to fight that virus off on its own without any medical intervention. And so the amount of virus goes down after a period of time.
Okay.
So, and then creeps back up much more slowly over time. And that's with no medical interventions, so no medications. But yeah, it's at that initial infection that a person is a high infection risk to a partner.
Now, many think that only gay people, LGBT community, or drug addicts can get this virus, but this is, of course, wrong. Everybody's at risk for it, right?
This is true. I once heard someone say, it's not who you are, what you do, it's a combination of all of those things, right? So when we look at a community, the GLBTQ population bears a burden of this disease. There are more infections in that community, but it's not the fact that someone belongs to that community that's putting them at risk. It's not knowing a partner's status and having a way for that virus to enter the body. So if I don't know my partner's status and I'm having unprotected sex or I'm sharing a needle, then I have a method for that virus to get into my body.
How much has the increase in this spike in addiction of heroin affected the issue of HIV and AIDS in the United States?
I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in Indiana, but there was an injection drug community where there was an astronomical number of new infections that happened through sharing. And so it is really high on people's radar. It's high on our agency's radar because the reality is that it only takes one infection to spread to a whole community. So I think it's wonderful that it's so high on people's radar. And I think that it has encouraged agencies like Equitas Health to do more promotion amongst that population of prevention strategies like a pre-exposure prophylaxis, where an individual could take a medication daily that would prevent or work to prevent an HIV infection.
Are those expensive, though?
Those are expensive. And so a lot of insurance will cover it. There are some assistance programs out there in the world of expensive drugs. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that can be navigated if one were to talk to their primary care provider, if there were a financial counselor available. Those are things that most knowledgeable primary care providers could discuss.
Let's talk about that test that Prince Harry did on Facebook. And by the way, anybody can Google this and find it. It's easy to find. But tell us what exactly happens with that test. What is it? It's just a pinprick, right?
Yeah. So it's very similar to blood sugar, where there is a clip done of the skin. You get a drop of blood, you put it into a test and add a chemical solution, which provides a reaction and gives a result in 60 seconds.
Is it something like a pregnancy test where all of a sudden a little line brightens or something like that?
Something similar to that. There's a clear signal. It's a CLIA wave test. And what that means is that a person can conduct that test with no medical training.
Right.
They can be trained by the test manufacturer and read it appropriately. So similar to a pregnancy test in that way.
And where can somebody get this test, like, say, in Central Ohio? Is it easily accessible?
So there is only, to my knowledge, there's only one home test on the market. So there's somebody could go to a drugstore or your local grocery store that has a pharmacy and purchase a home test kit and administer their own kit.
You don't need a prescription for that?
You don't need a prescription for that. The price point is anywhere between, you know, $20 to $60. Sometimes pharmacists keep them behind the counter because they're at that price point. But an individual could go and administer that test to them at home. That's not necessarily what we recommend as an organization that knows that connecting someone to services, whether that be social or medical services, is so important. But that is an option. And the best HIV test is the one that a person's comfortable taking.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals can come to organizations like ours and get that blood test. So where they do a finger prick and they get a result, you know, in a minute.
Do you have to make an appointment to do something like that?
Most agencies offer some form of walk-in testing. Our organization here locally in Columbus has walk-in testing 5 days a week at one of our offices.
Is there an issue of more rural areas not having access to testing?
Yeah. So when you look at the free HIV test sites around Ohio, there are pockets that don't have testing available. And so transportation or access to those sites can be a barrier for someone. There is a website that is ohiv.org. It is a statewide resource for HIV and STI testing. And that is a resource that can link people with the closest test site. They can find information about test sites all over Ohio. And if they call the hotline associated with that website, a hotline operator could help them figure out the most accessible point of entry for testing.
Again, that's ohiv.org. We'll post a link to that website on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment about this issue, give us a call right away, 614-292-8513. How often do you recommend somebody get tested for HIV? Is 23 years too long for me to wait?
23 years is probably longer than we would recommend for most folks. There's a few guiding principles here. The CDC recommends that everyone ages 16 to 64 get an annual HIV test. That is a great recommendation, and a lot of folks can work that into their annual preventative care that mm-hmm. they do. For other folks that maybe have a more frequent change in partners or have higher risk situations, so maybe their partner is positive, we would recommend more frequent testing. And it's, again, to some degree dictated by what the person's comfortable with. There are some people who will get tested every 3 months, and that's wonderful. If someone's high risk, knowing that they're infected reduces their risk of infecting a partner. For individuals that are in what we would call those high-risk demographics, so men that have sex with men or that LGBTQ population, we would recommend once every 6 months if they don't have a regular primary partner. But we are offering a lot of other options for testing. So we have couples testing, okay, where a person could come and make an agreement with their partner about how they best protect each other and know each other's status. We're offering a lot of those kinds of services so that, again, there's a spectrum of testing options available, and everyone can pick what they're comfortable with.
Well, Tanya Slack-Peterson, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tanya Slack-Peterson. She's Director of Prevention at Equitas Health. Yeah, that's the former AIDS Resource Center. We'll have a link to that, to their website, on ours at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're in the dog days of summer now, and there's a meal plan for that. With more rain on the way, temperatures in the high 80s, low 90s, and humidity reaching 50% this week, I'm hoping that my tomato plants will start to ripen. But in the meantime, light, crisp meals of salads, fruits, and veggies are on tap. Easier said than done, right? Sally Kazamchek is a registered dietitian, creator of the blog Real Mom Nutrition, and author of the 2014 cookbook Cooking Light Dinnertime Survival Guide. Feed your family, save your sanity. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You recently wrote about how to build a salad, and I remember I learned how from the a famous old cookbook, but I learned how to build a salad that way. And what's your formula?
Well, I think that it's really important. Salads are very popular, especially in the summer months, because, you know, people don't want to turn on their stove or their oven. You know, your appetite kind of drops. You just want something cold and refreshing. But there's definitely a way to do it so that you're actually satisfied with that salad and you're not like going through the cabinets, you know, 10 minutes later after you finish. And so what I suggest is having some components in every single salad so you make sure that that salad is filling. So one is a filling grain, and I love putting grains in salads. That's something that some people haven't tried, but it's really good. So like a quinoa, which I know is technically
just
a seed.
Sort of sprinkle it as a condiment in the salad, you mean?
Well, no, I put probably about a half a cup.
Okay.
In my salad, or farro, which is a whole grain, which is really delicious. You could even put rice. And then I always have some kind of protein source. Now, this does not have to be meat. It could be. It could be some like leftover grilled chicken from the night before. It could be beans or chickpeas. Something that's going to give you protein, because protein is the most satisfying nutrient. If this salad's going to be your meal, you want to be satisfied with it. And I also like having a source of healthy fat in the salad. Again, fat is very satisfying, and those healthy fats are good for our hearts. So something like an avocado, or it could be your dressing is olive oil based, or you could have some seeds or nuts. All those are sources of healthy fats. Mm-hmm. And then I love adding, just for a flavor and color, some kind of fruit. So right now you could slice up strawberries, you could put blueberries, you could put, I love in the fall and winter to do chopped apple or pear. And then any kind of veggie you have in your refrigerator. So maybe you have leftover roasted veggies from the night before. Put them in cold. I love roasted butternut squash or roasted sweet potato. Anything you have in your fridge. Salads are a great way to get all those vegetable servings. And most Americans do not get nearly enough vegetable servings a day. So it's a great vehicle to just kind of toss it all in.
And when you're talking about a salad and you're talking about leafy greens, I mean, there's the iceberg lettuce generation that, you know, people who grew up with that. And that
I
was
did.
Pretty much
yep.
it because that's what was in the grocery store. Now we have a lot more choices.
Yeah.
Are you an advocate of that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the darker green vegetables, darker green leafy vegetables are going to have more nutrients than your sort of white iceberg lettuce. However, I say whatever lettuce you like the best, you know, if you really love iceberg, that's okay. Or you can mix it. There was just something out recently about how bagged salads have gotten people away from iceberg and into more the mm-hmm. leafy, the romaine
right.
and the mixed. I think that's great. I think bagged salads are fantastic. Some people are kind of down on bagged salads because they don't think they're fresh, and that's absolutely not the case. So if bagged salads will help you eat those salads because you don't have to chop and wash your lettuce, you know, eliminates that step, then I say go for it. And whatever kind of mix you like the best, but certainly throw in some, even some chopped kale. I throw in some shaved Brussels sprouts. I just take my knife and kind of shave them a little
raw?
Bit and throw that in. Raw.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, raw Brussels sprouts. And you can just have a really nice mix of greens and nutrients and textures in there.
We're talking about eating light for the summer. My guest is Sally Kajemchek. She is a registered dietitian, creator of the blog Real Mom Nutrition. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. She's also the author of a book. We talked about it before. It's always good to refer back to it, though. Cooking Light, Dinner Time Survival Guide, Feed Your Family, Save Your Sanity. So she knows what she's talking about. She's a mother as well. If you have a question or comment, if you have an idea of how you eat light in the summer, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're now the proud owners. Our new baby is a Vitamix.
Congratulations.
We do smoothies almost every morning mm-hmm. now. It's what I do. And I put a protein powder in there and do all of that kind of stuff. It's not necessarily low calorie, but it's delicious and we'll drink it and we'll eat it. That's kind of what this is about. Try to figure out what you'll eat.
Yeah, and smoothies, again, are a great meal for the summer because who wants to eat a, you know, bowl of hot oatmeal in the summer? And it's nice. It's cold and refreshing. You can take it to go. So, yeah, smoothies are hot, and they have been hot for several years now. And I just had a post on my blog about choosing a blender.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are out shopping for a blender and wanting to know which one they should buy. And as you were teasing me before the show started, I admitted in my post, I own 4 blenders, which is ridiculous.
I'm just jealous. And where do you put them all? Is the other thing.
My husband wonders the same thing. So I originally did get a Vitamix. That was my first one. It was like Christmas morning, you know. I was excited to
exactly.
get that Vitamix.
I took a picture and posted it.
I did too. And it is like a baby.
Well, it's like a piece of furniture too. It's expensive.
It is expensive. And it is truly like the classic. I really think you cannot go wrong with a Vitamix. And I used mine probably every single day at least once until these new blenders came into my life.
Until the usurpers.
But I don't want people to think that they have to spend that amount of money. So absolutely, especially if you're going to do like nut butter or soups, you know, you can do a ton of things in the Vitamix. But if you just want something, you know, small and portable and easy to do smoothies, you can actually get things on blenders under $100 that work really well. And in that blog post, I talk about a couple of them, like the Nutribullet. Jamba has a new blender out that's actually quiet. It has a shield that fits over it.
Wow.
That muffles the sound, which is really nice because some of those blenders, my husband's like, it's like a jet engine taking off in our kitchen.
I actually thought my husband was running it this morning to clean the container, and I was outside in the patio thinking, whoa, is there a plane going? It's so funny you said that. So anyways, go ahead. So what are some of these other ones?
Yeah, so the Jamba is, I think it's about $150. There's the Nutribullet. I like the Nutribullet because it's really small. Mm-hmm. I call it my travel blender, which some people may
you
think
bring it on
I'm
vacation?
Completely nuts. Yes, to bring my blender on vacation. You know, I start every morning with a smoothie, and to me, I feel good when that's my breakfast.
So what do you put in one? In the summertime, what do you put in
them? It really depends. So I kind of go between sort of the more indulgent tasting sort of chocolate peanut butter. You know, that's what I had this morning. I had some almond milk, a frozen banana. I really like the PB2 powder, which is the peanut powder.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I have the chocolate PB2 powder. Sometimes I put dates in to sweeten them. And a trick to doing that is to soak your dates in milk overnight in a container. And then when you put them in the blender, they just pulverize really quick.
Okay.
And that's a great way if you feel like you have to put honey or some kind of sweetener into a smoothie. Dates are actually a really natural way to sweeten your smoothie. But I also love the green smoothies too. I love, you know, spinach and pineapple and banana, or right now it's peaches. So spinach and peaches and some almond milk is a really good complement to the spinach and the fruit. A trick that I use that I recommend is I take a lot of spinach and put it in my blender with some water, and I puree it, and I pour that into an ice cube tray. And once it's frozen, I pop those cubes out into a plastic bag and keep them in the freezer, and then you can just put a couple of those in your green smoothie and blend instead of having the leafy greens always on hand.
Interesting.
Yeah. So in case you haven't gotten to the store, you just ran out of spinach or kale or whatever it is, you can put some of those cubes in the blender.
I freeze cut up lemons, bananas, ginger, that kind of a thing, because they don't keep as well, and it's better that way. You know, you can just keep them longer, just do it all, a whole bunch at one time. But that's an interesting idea for
the spinach. Or if you have, you know, say you have like a box of pre-washed spinach, and it's a little bit on the edge, like it's not quite nice enough for a salad.
Exactly.
Puree it, and it's great for smoothies, and then you can just keep it until you need it. It'll last in the freezer a long time.
Ava in Clintonville, you're on the air.
I was just thinking about things that we do to eat light, and I am almost embarrassed to say that we just bought a spiralizer. So it makes like those like zucchini into zucchini noodles kind of thing. And we have been eating so many vegetables because we bought that. And the other thing that I do that that has really helped is we get a crop share from Peace, Love, and Freedom Farms every Monday. And so every Monday I Google all of the different things that we got and I come up with recipes. So actually I want to get the Vegetable Butcher book so that I can use, you know, all of her things. But so I don't have to use Google. But, you know, so we've been eating a ton of vegetables for dinner because, you know, I have been I've been using the spiralizer basically every single day. So we, you know, made cabbage fritters for dinner last night, and I used that thing to shred my cabbage. It was amazing. So anyways,
what are you embarrassed about? I'm embarrassed.
Yes,
I don't even know what a spiralizer is.
Oh my God. It's like embarrassingly amazing. It's this thing that's on, you know, it's as seen on TV.
Is it like Ronco? Okay.
I don't actually know what the brand is because my mom bought it for me because she had one and I was like, I need that thing. Oh my God. And it makes like noodles out of vegetables. And my kids are already pretty good veggie eaters, but my husband is like, I don't know about, you know, zucchini's not really my jam. And with that, I'm literally four nights last week, we ate zucchini noodles and it was amazing.
Have you heard about that, Sally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there are tons of recipes all over Pinterest for spiralized vegetables. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And oftentimes the spiralized veggies are standing in for pasta. I don't have anything against pasta, and I absolutely do eat pasta, but it's a great way to lower the calories and carbohydrates.
Yeah, I'm thinking of zucchini in particular. I mean, who isn't always looking for something to do with zucchini, right, Ava?
And you can spiralize anything.
Yeah, and you spiralize that and you put some spaghetti sauce over it. Yummy. All right, Ava, thanks a lot for that call. Anyone else has a great idea like that, give me a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was going to ask you about talk about salad dressing. We have an email from Lou who says, does your guest have any good resources for making homemade salad dressings? What's your trick?
Yeah. So one thing I do want to say is a couple of points about salad dressing. So one is that you do want to avoid fat-free salad dressings. And the reason is that you need some fat to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins.
Sort of a shtick. It's not really necessary.
No.
And you don't put that much in it.
Right. And that was my point, too, is that if you are thinking about weight management and calories and all of that with your salad dressings, just measure out about 2 tablespoons and toss it really well. That is really the key, is the tossing. So take tongs and toss your salad really well. When you toss it, a little bit goes a long way. So if you just kind of dump it on and start eating it, then some pieces have a lot, some pieces have a little, so toss it first. So yeah, I love making homemade salad dressings. I think when you start reading labels of a lot of the bottled salad dressings and you can't pronounce a lot of the ingredients and you think, shouldn't be this hard. And mixing up salad dressings is really easy. And so on my blog, I have a lot of different recipes. I love making all kinds of vinaigrettes. I have a recipe on there for a lighter Caesar that doesn't use raw eggs and uses yogurt in place mm-hmm. of that. So, but of course, there are also bottled salad dressings that are fine and that don't have a bunch of artificial stuff.
Well, I just start out with a couple tablespoons. If I'm doing a family salad, of olive oil, mm-hmm. toss it really well. And then do the whatever kind of vinegar I'm going to do with it, and maybe a little citrus. But then you want to wait to add all the other vegetables, or otherwise they make everything too soggy in there.
Yes.
And you want to get the leaves coated, right?
Yeah. And I love I love white balsamic vinegar. I don't know if you've tried
sure.
that.
Mm-hmm.
A friend introduced me to that several years ago, and I love that. And I don't know if people if you've seen the jarred salads. Have you seen that, Anne?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another thing you could do at the start of the week, is make all these salads. And if you're going to have like grains, put those on the bottom and then have your leafy greens on the top.
Okay.
So and you can have the different layers with nuts or cheese or protein, whatever. Have your leafy greens on the top. And then, yes, absolutely, keep your salad dressing separate and put that on right before you're going to eat it. Otherwise, it's going to be soggy.
Right. That's the only trick. Now, what's your recommendation for if you want to make a salad and keep it in the fridge? If you want to make a lot and be able to just kind of dig into that salad and add things as you go along during the week, depending on what the leftovers are. So a lot of people like to do that. Mm-hmm. They've got a Tupperware bowl that has a lid on it, and that's how they operate. What are your recommendations for that?
I think if you have everything mixed together in a bowl, that it is going to get soggy. So I keep my containers all separate. So the trick for greens is if I don't buy pre-washed, if I chop and wash them myself, as I put them, I chop them, wash them, use the salad spinner, put them in a big Ziploc bag with a paper towel to absorb the excess moisture, mm-hmm. press as much air out of it, and that'll keep for quite a long time. And then I have my other ingredients prepped, but in separate containers. So then all I have to do is pull out the containers and mix it up. Or another option is to do the jarred salads, which do keep those ingredients separate from each other because they're in the layers.
Have you been doing jarred salads?
I have done them. I mean, I don't do them all the time because I work at home, and so it's pretty easy for me to throw a salad together. But for somebody going to work, I think it's a great thing. Make 4 or 5 for the week and then grab them.
And what size jar do you think?
I use the big ball mason jars. Mm-hmm. So is that a quart? I think it's a quart.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a quart jar. And you can really cram a lot into it. You'd be surprised. You can really shove it all down in there and then take a bowl or something so that you dump it out into the bowl when you're at work and add your dressing.
Uh-huh. And so, like I said, when I make a salad, I kind of do it. It's a process for me. I don't make the dressing ahead of time and then put it over it. But what's your favorite dressing to prep ahead of time, maybe to bring along on a picnic or something like that?
I have a vinaigrette on my blog called Everyone Loves This Vinaigrette.
Because
okay. Every time I make it and I have people over, whatever, people always ask me about that dressing.
Uh-huh.
And I do use the white balsamic, which is the key. But it is really a very simple olive oil, balsamic vinegar, a bunch of different herbs and mm-hmm. spices, a little bit of sugar. I know. You could leave that out. But yeah, I mean, I always get compliments on it. So I'm a vinaigrette girl. And then I have a recipe on my blog for an apple, a creamy apple vinaigrette. You actually you can make it in your Vitamix.
Yummy.
And you put fresh chopped apple in it and blend it together. And it's really delicious.
I'm going to have to get that recipe for
yeah.
now. Thank you, Sally Kazamchuk, for talking with us. I appreciate it as always. Sally is a registered dietitian, creator of the blog Real Mom Nutrition, author of the 2014 cookbook Cooking Light, Dinnertime Survival Guide, Feed Your Family, Save Your Sanity. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for those great calls and great ideas. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.